Welcome, guys. Today we have the pleasure of Elliot Godzich joining us. Elliot is a senior software engineer at Juniper Square, a private equity software firm in San Francisco, California, USA. Elliot, do you mind sharing with us? Well, first of all, I want to share with our audience why you're such an amazing guest to have on.
Thanks.
Why your experience is super interesting and relatable to virtually everybody in tech, which is that I think a lot of people have this idea in the back of their heads that they want to start their own startups eventually, even if it starts out as part-time as opposed to full-time. And you having actuated that decision, started your own startup, I think, in the last couple of years, and then you made the really difficult decision, maybe not so difficult decision, to abandon that plan and re-enter the workforce as a full-time employee, salaried and whatnot. But I think it would be great to hear from you about what your decision-making was to start the startup with your co-founder and walk away from your full-time job, and also how you made the decision to wind down and go back into full-time employment. So for our audience that doesn't know you personally, do you mind sharing for people your background from college through to today?
Sure. So coming out of college, I was working for a company called Originate. They were somewhere between a venture capital firm and a consulting firm. So we kind of did small gigs for various companies in exchange for both cash and some sort of upside. And I stayed there for about 2 years. I was working in Scala, which was really fun. But I left because I wanted to kind of get deeper into projects. So I'm sure you can imagine, like, you get really good at starting projects, and then you're like, "What? I'm bored now."
For
so,
sure.
So I left and joined a small startup. At the time was 10 people doing e-commerce retail advertising on Facebook. So I switched from being kind of a full stack engineer at that point in my career to being only a back end engineer. So I was kind of doing this ads automation system. It was a mostly distributed systems kind of work. A lot of like work queue balancing and management kind of stuff. I worked there for about 2 years before we got acquired by Rakuten Marketing. It was kind of a big change, as you can imagine, going from we had grown up to 24 people, I think, and then Rakuten Marketing was a 15,000 person, or Rakuten as a whole is a 15,000 person company. Rakuten Marketing was like 3,000 or something.
Yeah, they're an enormous Japanese conglomerate that are kind of making their way through acquisitions into the United States tech marketplace.
Yeah. Rakuten Marketing specifically is entirely composed of acquired companies. There is no actual Rakuten Marketing core. So as you can imagine, the cultural situation at Rakuten Marketing was a complete mess because there was no central culture to kind of wrap around, because it was every single one of these companies were just coming together with their own culture and then just being forced into an office that none of them chose.
For sure. So yeah. You'd worked at this startup in the e-commerce space for 2 years, you
said? Yeah, about 2 years. And then I spent another 6 months at Rakuten Marketing.
Post-acquisition.
Post-acquisition before I decided to leave.
You were telling me about some of the more radical changes that you had to deal with through your employer getting acquired. And so we'll get to the topic of your startup and your decision to leave Rakuten. But do you mind sharing for people what the acquisition was like working at a tech startup that got acquired by an enormous conglomerate?
So at first we just started getting kind of office visits from them, right? They were thinking about buying us. So of course this was like a big deal. Everyone's like, "Oh, what's happening? What does this mean?" And our bosses really couldn't tell us anything because we don't know what it means yet. But we'll let you know when we do. And eventually, you know, you have people coming in and doing technical due diligence. So my head of engineering was just completely out of the picture for weeks on end because he was just basically deep diving with someone technical on their end to make sure that there weren't any like dead skeletons in our closet, technically speaking. And I'm sure the same sort of thing was happening on the business end. And then eventually they told us, we're acquiring you. And so they kind of took each of us into a room separately and put a bunch of paper on the table and said, you know, this is the terms of the acquisition for you. Because you're essentially getting rehired at a new company now. Mm-hmm. So this is your new salary. This is your new stake in the new company. This is how much money you're receiving just all at once for getting acquired. This is where the new office is. And they had literally printed out a special map for each person. Like, this is your new commute. Like,
wow.
Yeah. And I was going from having 20 minutes of walking outside as part of my commute, as part of my 40 minute commute, to now having to drive 45 minutes at a bare minimum, but that's what the map said because that's the distance on Google Maps. But with traffic, it was actually an hour and a half a lot of the time.
Did you have to re-interview for your own job like some people do?
No, I didn't have to do that. They just hired everyone. They did talk to each of us, and I guess we all seemed decent enough people. So there was no kind of intense vetting of people, but that sounds really scary. I can't even imagine what that feels like.
For sure.
I have to re-interview to keep working here.
Well, there were other aspects of that transition that you were telling me about before we started recording that were kind of grating. You were just describing that there was no real culture there after acquisition.
Yeah, and everything became a lot more complicated too. So I was the head of backend. And so when I decided I wanted to build something, I just kind of built it. I planned it. I know, it's amazing, right? I would plan it. I would kind of break it down into stories and farm pieces of it out to my engineers. And things would get done. It was great. And if I needed to kind of understand priorities, I would go talk to my CEO. I would go talk to my head of product. Magical. Shifting over to Rakuten Marketing, though, things got more complicated because there are all these kind of financial things that you had to do. They were trying to save a lot of money by capitalizing projects. I don't know if you know what that means, but the basic gist of it is any software you write that is kind of adding new functionality to your software, anything that's non-maintenance basically, can be considered as a capital asset that you're building. And so it's taxed differently. It's taxed as a depreciating asset.
Interesting.
And so we had all these crazy requirements to time how long we spent coding capitalizable projects versus non-capitalizable projects. And as you can imagine, as a software engineer, you're just switching between branches, and suddenly you have to go to a time tracker and click all these things. And it was crazy. My engineers basically mutinied on doing time tracking, and so I was kind of just estimating all of this for them. And to build things, you had to kind of get your roadmap approved. So whenever I came up with a thing, I had to go through this whole set of meetings just to even start building it. And often, we were working with Facebook, right? They were our lifeblood, and they were kind of constantly building what we built with an 18-month lag. And so our advantage was how agile we were. And now we kind of were getting weighted down, and that 18-month gap is much smaller now. So it was very unideal from in a lot of situations, but yeah, it was not great. So
is the counting hijinks, or not hijinks, but requirements that were imposed on you something that you found to be unique from your peers' experiences post-acquisition or working for larger companies? This is the first I've ever heard of having to do time tracking to service accounting priorities.
Yeah, I don't know, honestly. I think I've heard that Amazon does things like this sometimes. Mm. The other thing that was definitely complicated was hiring. So I had been doing a lot of hiring as the lead of a back-end team. And at my startup, it was a pretty easy process. I mean, hiring is never easy, actually, but that's a different topic. But I was in full control of the process. And so I didn't even think about it. I thought I was still in control of the process. So I was just kind of still going on with my hiring. And then about a month and a half into me working on hiring, suddenly I get very angry emails from HR. Like, oh, we're the people who do hiring. And I was like, I did not realize like there's a whole specialized department for this. And so the way we wanted to do hiring was very different from how the way they wanted to do hiring. And we were pretty convinced that, you know, being able to talk engineer to engineer immediately was a great way to like pull people in initially, because a lot of people are kind of turned off by the ads industry. I've found that when talking to engineers, if you actually present the technical challenges to them first, they get more excited about it. Mm-hmm. And they were basically saying, we get to be the first people to talk to them before you. And since we were doing analytics on our entire hiring funnel, I can tell you that definitely had a really bad effect at the top of the funnel.
Oh, I
There's just lots of stuff like that, that like just a lot more process, a lot more people involved in any single thing you do. And I get it. It's a big company. You kind of have to, but, it was cultural whiplash going from 24 people to, 15,000 person company.
So the bureaucratic red tape, the process changes, the cultural changes, by this point you had saved up a financial nest egg to be able to do without full-time employment for a while. So I think a lot of people understand why you'd want to leave that role post-acquisition and encountering all these roadblocks.
They were paying me a lot though. Fair enough. Because they're a big company, they can afford it. That's how they retain people, I think.
For sure. So how did you manage to break free of the golden handcuffs? Break out on your own.
So I was, you know, really unhappy, and I was thinking about leaving for a while, and I spoke to my boss about it because we had a really good relationship, and still do. I had dinner with him last night. He said, you know, Jose, our head of product, who left, he had left like a few months prior. He seems to be working on some sort of VR thing, or thinking about working on it anyway. You should go have dinner with him. So I went and had dinner with him, and he tells me that he's become really interested in the VR space and wants to build a company around a telecommuting app in VR. And I'm sitting here going, well, I want to quit my job, and that sounds way more fun than what I'm doing right now, which is essentially just being in meetings all day to get very little done. So I said, yeah, I'm down. Let's do this. Give me a month to, you know, transition out of my job, and I'll join you. I'll give this a shot. So a month later, I go and find him in this tiny room that he's renting in a school for animation, like right across the street from Pixar.
Nice.
The room was smaller than this room. It was like from here to like, it was like maybe 10 feet across and 6 feet wide. Wow. And so we had a desk on each side, and we were working in VR. So it was kind of a hilarious situation because we both had VR headsets and we're both, I don't know if you know how the HTC Vive works. It has those light boxes that are
corners.
Yeah, that are emitting light, encoded light into the room that are picked up by all the sensors. So we were sharing the light boxes, but when we were both in VR at the same time, we couldn't see where the other person was. So there was like constant like bumping into each other and like all this stuff. But it was really cheap rent for an office space that was less than 10 minutes from both of us. So we made it work.
Nice.
But yeah, so I just decided, you know, I'm going to try and start a startup for the first time. I've tried it before, but not like dedicating the full-time work to it. And so we just went for it.
Did you guys from day one concern your guys' selves with obviously costs, but what about revenue? Did you guys have a calendar date by which you wanted to be signing your first customer or making your first money?
Yeah, so I think that was honestly our biggest mistake was not like if I had to kind of retrospect on the whole experience, I think the biggest mistake we made was not getting customers first. And I honestly think like between the startup experience and all of my interviewing that I did afterwards with startups, because I was now talking to them about like what the experience of being a founder instead of like being an engineer, which is actually a great thing to do in interviews, I found. And gave me so much to talk about. I found that all the successful startups I spoke to were almost none of them had a product before they had their first customer.
Interesting.
They would, a lot of these really successful founders were going around and speaking to people in the industry they were trying to serve and understanding their problems deeply. And then getting buy-in from people to say, hey, we're going to build a product. And they had like mock-ups, basically, like here's what it would look like, but they had not built any of it yet. And they say, are you interested? Would you pay for this? And okay, you will pay for it, sign this contract, and when we get it built, we'll give it to you and start charging you for it. So they basically get to the point where they have like three or four customers signed on, and it's enough to like pay rent for the office to like keep and like give you like food. Basically.
Yeah.
And if you can get to that kind of steady state, then everything else is much better from there. Because it's really like morally draining to be in the situation I was in, which was building the product first and then trying to find customers later.
For sure.
For sure. Because you've invested a lot more at that point. And it turns out if no one wants what you're building, there was no reason to do it in the first place. But it turns out you can find out if people want what you're building before you build it. And that had never really occurred to me before. And like, I think that's definitely the way to do it now.
So this might be specific to the startup that you guys were working on. But what do you think the impediments are to finding businesses that are willing to pay for what you guys were trying to build, which was, if you don't mind sharing, what exactly was it that you guys struck out to build?
Yeah, so we were trying to build telecommuting software in virtual reality. So the idea is, the kind of motivation behind it first was, I really think that there's like a special thing that happens when you're in person with someone as far as communication bandwidth goes. There's facial expressions, there's body language, just all this stuff. And video chat just doesn't actually capture it that well for me. Like, I don't know if you've ever tried to whiteboard collaboration with someone over video chat. It's not great.
I hate to interject, but there's an amazing article that's written, I forget the author, on the topic of bandwidth and latency, and bandwidth and latency in communication.
Yeah.
And what happens when bandwidth is reduced in communication, for example, you're not able to see the person's face in high res.
Mm-hmm.
You're not able to see their body language.
Yep.
And latency means delays in communication. So if any of you guys have ever been on a phone call or a screen share and there's
to,
a
like,
delay.
The other side of the world, oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
You're always interrupting each other, like, in the middle of a sentence without realizing it. Like, all this, it's terrible. So
this article that I was just mentioning goes on to mention the reason why a lot of employees haven't embraced
working
from home and working remote. And the author argues that it's a prisoner's dilemma situation, where if you have two employees who report to the same manager, it's important to signal to your manager your loyalty, your output. And if you can communicate your loyalty and output with higher bandwidth and lower latency.
So the cooperation move is to stay home, but the defect move is to go to your
manager. Exactly. And it's a brutally accurate analysis
in my perspective.
And really undermines what you guys might have been trying to do, which is push for more remote work technology. So,
yeah.
So what do you guys find in trying to build it?
Yeah, so we wanted to basically create a situation where you put the VR helmet on and you have a full body and the other person you're talking to has a full body. So you actually get body language and you get voice and it feels like you're actually in a room with someone and you have whiteboards and you have all this stuff. We basically just wanted to make a collaboration space that was actually more powerful than real life, because we built things like whiteboards that you could just pick up and just produce in midair, draw on them, like toss them over to your friend. Weightless whiteboards, you can copy paste them, you can undo, like, all this stuff. And it was great. We spent about 2 months prototyping the first version. It was a lot of learning because I had never done 3D programming.
Sure.
I'd never worked in VR. My co-founder was doing all the graphics. He had never built 3D models. He had never... So it was really funny because we would be like really productive for like 2 days doing a task, and then we'd hit some new concept like, oh, how does lighting work? And then like you have to just read the whole internet to understand how lighting works. And then you're like, okay, now I can set up lighting. And then you get there and you're like, oh, the lighting's like not... like has slowed everything down. And now you have to figure out how to do performance tuning for lighting. And performance tuning was really, really important in VR because basically if you're under 90 frames a second in VR, you can actually, you feel the world like not quite tracking you correctly. And it's very nauseating. Because imagine if like you turned your head and the world followed afterwards, like chunkily. It's not a great feeling.
Do you think that the immaturity of some of the software you were building on top of contributed to your guys' problems, or was the primary problem not finding paying customers fast enough?
So, okay, yeah. Let me get to how the business kind of didn't work out. So we spent 2 months building a prototype, and at that point we decided to go shop for investors. This was a very new experience for me, because I've done engineering before. So the first 2 months, which by the way were the most productive 2 months of engineering I've ever done in my life, despite all of the learning barriers, it's amazing what you can accomplish when you're heads down focused on just engineering and you have no other problems. Highly recommend that experience. We reached out to our personal networks and kind of said, you know, who knows VCs, and got a bunch of meetings with them, and actually demoed the product to them, put them in VR, and engaged, like kind of had the meeting in our app sometimes, which is kind of fun. Mm. Everyone was really, really compelled by the experience. They said, this is amazing. This is really cool. I think this would be a wonderful tool that the world wants. But as you may or may not know, the HTC Vive is pretty expensive. It's, at the time, it was $800. There was a recent price drop because Oculus and HTC are kind of fighting.
We had a video recording a week or two back where we did a price comparison of your different VR options. And
oh yeah, I saw.
All in, I think it's $2,000 for the computer with the right GPU.
Yep, exactly.
And the Vive headset.
So this is exactly what they brought up. They said, so right now, to use your application, the barrier to entry is $2,000 before they even start paying for your application. Not only that, but it's bound to a room. Like, I can't use it anywhere else. And for all of the investors, that was a non-starter. They said, there's no way you're going to make it in the enterprise space with those kinds of barriers to entry, on top of already being an experimental concept. Mm-hmm. These meetings were both encouraging in terms of people shared excitement for our vision, but also discouraging in terms of, well, the implementation's not really working out. So we brainstormed for a bit, and then we said, you know what we could do to work around this is port the application to Google Daydream. So Google Daydream is a VR system where you basically have this $25 headset that you slot your phone into, mm-hmm. and then you just put it on, and so it's portable. And most people already have phones. So now the barrier to entry is reduced to $25, and there's no, it's mobile. So you can work, if you're traveling, you can still teleconference into your meetings. So porting it to mobile was its own kind of technical challenge. We found we were able to get away with it was like 1/10 of the polygons in a scene. So our first...
So you're already reducing the bandwidth of the communication.
Exactly. Well, there was already... the graphics, I don't think, were the most important part of the application. It was the... it was like having the body language and the voice. And those things, those were some of what was lost. So with HTC Vive, you had a headset and two wands, and using inverse kinematics, you could figure out where the person's arm should be, where the person's body should be as a result of that. So we had full body language in the Vive. The Daydream doesn't have any hands. It has a remote, but the remote's SDK only gives you where it is pointing. It doesn't give you a position in space.
So you don't have any gravitometer or...
Accelerometer. Yeah, I don't know what technology they use in it, but it's something strange.
Point being, porting from Vive to Daydream killed a lot of the attractive features of what you guys were trying to build.
Exactly. The headset also lacked translational tracking, so it could tell you where you were pointing in space, but couldn't tell you where you are in space. Mm-hmm. So from a first-person perspective, when you were in the new application, if you moved your head like this, the room moved with you, mm-hmm. Which is not great. But more importantly, from a second-person perspective, if I was interacting with you before, if you had like jumped for joy or like done like a little dance, it would have like looked like a very happy little avatar. Now it was just a bobblehead. The body doesn't move at all, and you're just this like head on a swivel, and there's no way to get around it. Mm-hmm. Just the platform doesn't give us enough data to actually recreate your body language. And between all of these factors, it killed the experience. We, even as founders who were excited about it, could no longer tell ourselves that this was better than video chat. Mm. So we were stuck between a rock and a hard place, because there are a business requirement on this side and a technical requirement on this side that couldn't meet to make our vision a reality.
At what point did it kind of dawn on both you and your co-founder, or just you, that this wasn't going to shake out business-wise and career-wise for you?
Yeah, so it was a slower death than I would have liked. Here's how it kind of went down. We were porting the app, and I think we were slowly realizing in the back of our heads, but it hadn't kind of like made it up to my consciousness yet that this was a failure. As a result, it was a, at this point, we were no longer in the same office. As soon as we got the first prototype working, we got rid of the office and started only communicating through our app. Yeah, because it was cheaper. We're big believers in dog fooding, like using your own product.
For sure.
So, because basically you get rid of the most annoying things of your app first. you smooth out the user experience to please yourself.
Fair enough.
So, I noticed that my productivity was slipping compared. It was some of the worst productivity weeks I've ever had in my life. Like, it was taking me 2 weeks to accomplish what during that first month was taking me half a day. To kind of give you the level of like that was near the end, but it was like slowly kind of dying in motivation. And I was feeling guilty, you know, I was like, I'm letting my co-founder down. But the same thing I noticed was happening to him. He was also really, really slowing down, and we weren't talking about it for a while. And then finally, like, I called him up and I'm like, hey, I think something's wrong. And he's like, yeah, it's not good. I think, like, I don't think there's anywhere for this to go. And we were actually in complete agreement. We just hadn't like come out and said it yet. So we just agreed to shelve the project. You never really like destroy a software startup. It's still a repo repository somewhere. But we said, you know, I think we need to like stop spending time on this, because we're both just feeling bad. And I don't think there's any way we couldn't really figure out any way to make it work. So time to cut the losses and continue on.
I know this is a little bit of nitty gritty detail for our audience, but I think for our audience members who are serious about wanting to start a business, did you guys incorporate as a business?
We did.
Did you have to disincorporate as a business or unincorporate?
I actually don't know what happened there. So we had, Jose was handling that side of things, near the beginning. He had some, I think he got in touch with the same lawyers that we were using at Manifest, to handle that stuff, to incorporate. You by default disincorporate if you don't pay your reincorporation fees every year. So
for sure,
yeah. So I think we just kind of let that process work itself out.
I know this may be sensitive information, but for our audience who are considering doing something like this themselves, and it differs depending on your business model and what you're setting out to build and how quickly you get to paying customers, but
yep.
All in, how much money did you forego?
Oh,
what,
sure.
What was the opportunity cost?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. Having been acquired recently, both Jose and I had, you know, had made a lot of money to kind of sit on, so we were like, we can just burn our own cash for a while and cut it as an investment, basically. When our plan was, when we get an investor, then we can pay ourselves the bare minimum to cover our own costs, like food and rent. Actually, this is a little detail left out, but we actually ended up finding someone who was willing to give us $25,000 near the end, but we decided not to take it because we were stopping the project and we were just like, that's
really,
we don't want to like, yeah, we don't want to do that. Over the course of 6 months from October to March, I burned through 25-30K. I was, you know, wait, does that make any sense?
That's 6 months, is that right?
Yeah. No, that doesn't make any sense. I think it was less than that. Anyway, I don't remember.
So somewhere around it, 20K?
Yeah, between 20 and 30K. And, you know, rent is killer.
For sure. And the opportunity cost of the salary that you might have otherwise
been getting. Yeah, and, you know, that money could be accruing interest, you know, all of that. But I would do it again. Coming out of that experience, I felt so much more self-motivated to work on projects long-term. And going into interviews for full-time positions after that, I had so much to talk about.
For sure.
Especially interviewing at startups, when I spoke to the founders, I found that I actually related to them a lot more now. I could talk about the business side of things. I could talk about what was it like during the early days, all of that. And I found that that made me much more engaging in my interviews than I had been before. It wasn't all focused around me as an engineer. I was kind of a more well-rounded individual to bring into their early stage startup.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Dude, this has been freaking awesome. Your story is, I think, very compelling to the vast majority of our audience. So I want to welcome people to check out the show notes, because we'll include a lot of links to the types of stuff we were just talking about.
Sure.
But also, if you guys have any questions for Elliot, get in touch with us through our website. There's a contact page.
Yeah, happy to answer any questions.
Absolutely. Dude, pleasure. We'll do this again very soon.
Cool.